to us is that the Zetas are hired by the richest men in the world. And mm-hmm. the funny thing is that the richest men in the world are not in Iraq, where you would imagine they were, or in Saudi Arabia. The richest men in the world are in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And Mexico has been having a silent war for more than 6 years, where there's nobody standing up or organizing or putting resistance on the Mexican government. What's really happening is that we fund Plan Merida. It's a $4 billion government-funded plan to fight drugs. But what you have to think about is that Mexico's economy has been crushed since NAFTA, even before that. Since the Mexican Revolution, the wages are the same, so poverty is stark in North Mexico. And of the population, it's about a 1.3 million. That's how many, how Juarez is populated. There's 1.3 million. And more than 60% of this population are under the age 25. And so with poverty and a large youth movement, there's not a war against drugs. There's a war against the youth. And it's the same kind of thing that's going on in Bahrain or in Yemen or in Egypt, where the youth are finally coming together and forming a movement, and right now the federal government is actually fighting the youth. But it's not transparent because the youth who sell drugs largely work for
the cartels.
The richest men in the world, they work for the cartels.
And those men were exposed in the WikiLeaks article. One thing I just want to go back, I just realized, you know, in the Mideast, there's so much exposure to the uprisings that are going on. In Mexico, that is right to our border, there is no exposure, and our histories are closely entwined. I mean, we basically stole the land. But
when you divide a country in half, you create the politics of exploitation. So if you think about El Paso del Norte, El Paso del Norte was one city. Juarez, Chihuahua was never the name of that city until the French invasion and the exile of the Mexican government in Chihuahua. So where I am right now is that I'm on the old seat of government before the Gadsden Purchase, where the Mexican government came in exile in the 1870s after the California land grab. There was an invasion from France, and Benito Juarez is the one that came to power at that time. He was an indigenous Indian. He was one of the first indigenous presidents of Mexico and resisted the French. So Juarez came to be named after him in 1888. And in Juarez, there's more than 70,000 young people that don't go to school, and the salary is the same as the 1928 Mexican Revolution.
And then you think about NAFTA's impact, and many are forced to migrate north.
So what NAFTA has done is that it's kind of we dump on Mexico, we're dumping, and the staple of Mexico is corn. So when we dump a low price GMO corn, the corn, the real natural growing good product of Mexico, is too expensive. So it's putting the farmers out of business. So everybody's having to migrate out of Mexico because, first of all, the salaries are the same. It's still like a socialist government. Everybody makes the same salary no matter what they do. So people turn to bribes and corruption. So we used to be able to go into Mexico, and what breaks my heart now is that we can't go there any longer.
And you're living right on the border. Are you near? You're in Las Cruces.
I'm in Las Cruces, New Mexico. It's the city. It's about 40 miles northwest of the border, right at El Paso, Texas, in this city that was divided completely in half at the river. So at one half, we have development. On the other half, we have the exploitation of the poor and of the youth. So we have missing. We have, in 2010 alone, 3,126 girls went missing with no formal investigation from the Mexican Attorney General's office.
Do you sometimes feel like you're living in a militarized zone yourself?
It is militarized here. We can't, in any direction from where I am, in any direction within an hour, there's federal checkpoints here and with dogs. And so anywhere you cross, they're putting dogs on the people. So that's an hour north towards Silver City. That's an hour northwest. There's an hour north towards Albuquerque. There's another checkpoint. And then there's one going east towards Alamogordo, and then there's one going south into Mexico. So we're surrounded on four sides by federal government, Homeland Security, and immigration, who actually, according to WikiLeaks, is working together with the federal government, and they're actually doing surveillance with drones in Mexico now.
Mm. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Well, the United States is controlling the drones in surveillance over Mexico. This is illegal. But
did
these
this come from the cables from the U.S. consulate?
Yes, this came. Well, so what happened is that there was an exposure by WikiLeaks, thank God, of a whole bunch of United States consular documents. And last month, the United States ambassador to Mexico resigned over these documents. So the Mexican Air Force and the U.S. Homeland Security and the Department of Defense are working together on intelligence. Mm. Now, what does this mean? If we think about what just happened, there was in a little town nearby us, it's called Columbus, New Mexico. On the other side is Palomas, and this is where Pancho Villa attacked the United States in the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. This little town, the mayor, the police chief, the trustee of the city, and eight other people have just been indicted for for arms smuggling into Mexico. And let's see if I can find the note. This was coordinated with the Department of Homeland Security as well. So they actually set up the city of Columbus, New Mexico. It was raided by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, and the DEA. And these people, the mayor,
Espinosa,
the police chief.
Whoops, I'm sorry. Elizabeth, what is the DEA?
It's the Drug Enforcement Agency. And these people were actually allowing for the purchase and exportation of arms. And they turned around and busted these people. They raided the southern New Mexico city of Columbus, the mayor, the police chief. All these people are in jail now for smuggling arms to Palomas, Mexico. Mm-hmm. I was there as a kid. My mom actually got married in Palomas when I was around 12. We go there for dental work, and, you know, people can't even cross the border anymore. But I think what happened in Columbus is these people are actually taking the fall for what's going along the whole border. This is a situation along the whole border, but somebody had to fall to distract what was going on. And it's a very small, small little city that where Pancho Villa attacked in 1916 that actually is the one being busted for smuggling firearms into Mexico. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the United States is controlling the surveillance. So what they did is they let these guns be smuggled into Mexico so they could see where they ended up.
I see.
They were almost set up.
And what is the La Luna cartel?
So it's La Línea. It means
La Línea.
The line. La Línea.
Can't
it means
read.
The
I
line.
Need to get my
it's
glasses.
A gang. Uh-huh. It's because, you know, at Juarez, it's the line. It's a border. It's a borderland. So what the line stands for is the line in the sand.
La Línea.
It's a drug cartel. And it's composed of corrupt police and corrupt soldiers. So it's another gang in Juarez as opposed to the Zetas. So the Zetas are providing protection to the richest men in the world. So the Zetas have been hired to provide protection. And this came out in WikiLeaks. It's dated March 16, 2011, El Paso Times via WikiLeaks. Juarez businessmen hire Zetas. The Zetas arrived in 2007, 2008 to purchase weapons from the Mexican army. Mm. At this time, the mayor moved out of there, moved into El Paso. There's another cable from WikiLeaks. The Zeta, Rogelio Lopez, he's a retired Mexican army. He joined the Zetas in 2007. This is right when this secret war starts. The cable, the WikiLeaks exposes that the U.S. government trains 5,000 Mexican military and 422 elite forces in Mexico. And these Mexican army, these retired Mexican army, have joined the drug cartel called the Zetas that provide protection to the wealthiest people in Mexico. The wealthiest people in Mexico control the media. And the media, like Televisor, Teleazteca, these media are controlling the way that they portray the drug war. And because there's such a high population of youth, that more than half of the population are under the age of 25 and living in poverty, with 70,000 of them not in school, and salaries as low as the Mexican Revolution. So these youth have taken up selling drugs.
Right,
but they're not interested in killing people. They're actually being targeted by the federal government in operation called Operation Chihuahua.
And really what's behind it are these men that were exposed in WikiLeaks.
So in WikiLeaks was exposed April 13th. It was published in Frontera Norte Sur, which means the border north-south. Mm-hmm. It's called Operation Chihuahua. This just happened again a year ago, where the Mexican federal police assumed control of local policing from the Mexican military, who used to manage the local policing. And then the police force was augmented with United States funding, United States training, and these federal officers came to Chihuahua. In Chihuahua, since Thursday, there have been a target of two discotheques where an average of 100 casings are found in the discotheque afterwards. They killed 20 people in 3 days. And they're kids. They're in the dam.
Yeah.
They're in the disco.
Jeez.
There's a high culture here
what
of movement and dance. It's vibrant. And it's the federal government from the south.
It's been infiltrated.
Fighting the kids in the north who are defensemen, who are living in poverty, who are trapped, who are victims of exploitation, where the young girls have been going missing.
It's
and
like
there's
a little
no investigation
Palestine.
From the federal government.
Yeah.
It's exactly like Palestine or Gaza. The people are trapped in Juarez. You can't cross north.
Keep
because
talking.
The
I have
United
to let
States
someone in.
Been.
Keep talking. I have to let someone in. One
oh, sure.
second.
The border of the United States and Mexico, established in 1853 after the Mexican-American War.
Nice.
Keeps the people trapped. It was largely militarized under the Clintons, but has been funded under the Bush government and the Obama government with the quote-unquote war on terror and our porous borders. So what's happening is that we have a system of bribes and corruption in Mexico, which has been there largely forever, because we used to pay bribes just to get across the border, to take clothes to our family, to get out of Mexico. If you got a ticket crossing a stoplight, you could pay a bribe. I participated in this system of paying bribes. But now it's absolutely out of control. So there's a lot of missing girls. In 1 year, there's more than 3,000 young girls. They're the age 15 that are going missing. And I think that these girls are part of human smuggling into the United States and a very lucrative brothel that are established in Georgia, in the Northeast, in Texas, and in California.
This has been going on for a long time, too, and it is truly a secret war. I mean, it's so sad what's going on in the Mideast, too, but there's so much more publicity. There's a reason for that.
Yeah, there's a sellout. So here, with the collapse of our economy, most people are losing their pensions and losing their retirement. What's happening in Mexico with the collapse of economy? The young people who work illegally selling drugs, they're losing their lives. That's how cheap life is in Mexico.
Yeah.
The rich man who hires them to move drugs along the border, who controls the media, who controls the judiciary, who controls with money, they sell out the young people working for them. And right now, it just was published in the newspaper yesterday or
is
day before yesterday.
The El Paso Times?
In the El Paso Times.
We're basically talking about everything that's already been published by WikiLeaks or in the El Paso Times. It's dangerous.
Yes, all this stuff is
this
already
too.
Published. We're just reviewing. Yeah, there was a recent death here on spring break. And if you pay attention, the people that were murdered in Juarez, they were Castros. They were from the Castro family. And this is an old family of old money that actually fled. They were part of the government in exile in the 1880s.
So
and
now
these
they're
people
being
still live. They're being targeted. So a family came from Phoenix, Phoenix, Arizona, over spring break to visit family in Juarez. And he was a 26-year-old. He was only 26, and another kid was there. They were visiting their family. They were Castros. The kid that died was named Reyes Castro, which means King Castro.
So
he was 26 years old, and he was shot when they were packing up to leave Mexico. A car just drove by, masked. Gun and just wiped them out. And there we would think there's no reason for this, but what's interesting, if you pay close enough attention to these people that are getting targeted, they're from the old government in exile in Chihuahua.
The old government that was originally the land that
they deposed of power.
Right.
Deposed of power and deposed of their land in the California land grab. Many of those families fled their lives into the northern part of Mexico after the border was reestablished in Juarez.
So they fled Juarez afterwards in Chihuahua.
They fled Juarez.
So they're there, mm-hmm. so that war is still going on. It's just mm-hmm. under a different guise right now.
Yeah, there's a disaster going on in Mexico, and not enough people are organized or paying attention because we're sitting on stolen Mexican land. I mean, there was a Mexican-American war that ended, and the Camino Real, the churches were sold on the Camino Real. But the land was still protected by the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. That means that every Mexican that had a land title confirmed to him in the 1830s was still sitting on his property when the land grab started to unfold in the 1870s. These land grab of the families, they're still in place. There are families that are still here in New Mexico. The Bush family, George Bush's family, his ancestor Samuel Prescott Bush, was actually the U.S. Marshal to New Mexico, and he went under the name Olinger or Klinger. And if you spell it backwards, it says redneck.
Have you seen those names? Have you seen those names down there? Those family names?
They're here. The New Mexico Spaceport director is Patricia Hines. This is the family that worked with the Bush family. They were married together. The Hines ketchup took over the Del Monte ketchup in Northern California. After the California land grabs were complete, they headed into New Mexico for the Lincoln County Wars. And these same families are here. The city commissioner is Billy Garrett. If you remember, Pat Garrett was the famous one shot here in the wars with Billy the Kid. His still name is Billy Garrett. He's the commissioner here. The county manager here is Brian Haynes. These are related to the Hines family. The director of the spaceport, the spaceport consortium, her name is Patricia Hines. The governor here, this running for governor, is Dolores Connor. These are the same families. They stretch from California into Arizona, into New Mexico, and they're in all politically privileged positions. So what happened in Columbus, New Mexico, with the United States Homeland Security busting these government officials right on the border, that's happening along the whole border. So if you notice, one of the articles that WikiLeaks published is that the Zetas, they control this border of Texas, Laredo, Texas, Nuevo Laredo. It's on Laredo on the Texas side and New Laredo on the Mexican side. And they've actually taken over the local police there, and they control both sides of the border. So that's why I really largely have to stay anonymous, because people, especially media reporters, are being targeted for analyzing these kind of developments in Mexico.
I see. My co-host just arrived. His name is Bear.
Hi.
So I just want to introduce you to him, Elizabeth.
Hi, Bear.
I don't know. Oh, somebody's at the door there. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end pretty soon. We have another guest coming on at 3:30, and we did just scratch the surface of this, and I had a feeling that might happen because we only had half an hour. But either next week or the following week, we can go into this in much more depth, and also the impact of NAFTA and what it's like for you to live right in the militarized zone on the border, and what's happened to the people that you grew up with, the neighborhood that you lived in, and how oppressive that must be.
Abandoned. Half of all the businesses are abandoned, and a third of the homes, more than half of the homes, abandoned. 230,000 people have fled since Calderon came to power. So of the 1.3 million, 230,000 have already left. And the people that can't leave are stuck in poverty there, and they can't migrate out because of the immigration laws.
And the prevalence of the fear, too.
Yeah, everybody's afraid. Everybody's
dying,
talking about it here, but nobody is court. Nobody's active. There's no activity going on in Facebook. There's no coordination. There's no pressure on the Mexican government. Bribes rule the day. Murder, extortion, no formal investigation. Young women kidnapped, raped, and mutilated. No investigation by the Mexican state attorney general. I mean, Juarez is a disaster. It's just like what's happening in Bahrain, where the United States is allowing foreign troops in there to establish, to keep stable their, you know, their political relations with that government. The United States is also allowing this to happen by funding the federal government in Mexico. That's an illegitimate government. And Mexico's in a civil war, but nobody talks about the truth.
Yeah.
It occurs to me, I did my thesis on the war on drugs in Latin America, and at that time, about 15 years ago, it was Colombia that was such the, and it seems like it's become Mexico is now.
Yeah.
No. It is. We have Plan Merida. It's just like Plan Colombia. And there's rumor that FARC is actually in Mexico. They're the ones that have, because they're covered up. They're not tagged who they are. The faces are covered and they're highly armed.
Yeah.
And there's impunity. Nobody's being charged for these things. And since Thursday of last week, 20 youth have been killed in the discotheques in Juarez. It's a war against the youth, where the population of Mexico, of Juarez,
well, that's
of
the future
million,
generation.
It's a young generation, under 25.
But that's the future. That's Mexico's future. And it
and
seems to be centering and spreading out to
the
rest of the country. Elizabeth, we are going to have to go. Our next guest is here, but I want to have you on hopefully next week or definitely the week after that, and we can talk for an hour or maybe more.
Well, that's good just to get the statistics out there
we'll
people
start
can look
with the
again
statistics,
at our own revolution
and we'll
right
go into
near
the
us.
History. Exactly. Well, thank you again for just your wealth of information and your willingness to be flexible. All right.
You're welcome.
Well, thank
Alrighty.
You. Good
okay,
to talk
have
to
a good
you.
Day.
Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Great, that was Elizabeth Rodriguez, and our next guest is here, and that's Andy Courtier, and he is the author of A Different Kind of Luxury, and we're going to be learning about what it is to, well, not just simplify our lives, but also how we as consumers are being consumed, and what it is to truly live, not just close to nature, but intimately, and the cycles of life live close to the land, and to resist the pressures of our materialist culture and that of Japan and the intense conformity that the individuals that he interviewed are under and how they've charted their own existence. And in the meantime, I'm going to put on Beautiful World Existence for you. One moment.
Cuentas a la ciudadanía y ese es nuestro trabajo. Si no nos unimos como ciudadanía, si salimos 300, si salimos 400, no sirve de nada.
lom lom lay how, lom lay how, lom 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 lay di di. He lom lom lay how, lom lay.
Well, that was Warriors on the Way. And our second guest has arrived, Andy Couturier. I pronounced that correctly?
Couturier.
Couturier, I'm sorry.
That's right.
And Bear is here co-hosting with me. And Andy, it's a real honor to have you here. He just returned from India a short while ago. And he is the author of a most amazing and unusual book entitled A Different Kind of Luxury, where he had the opportunity to interview, I think it was 11 individuals. And he is very inspired. They're philosophers, farmers, and artists that are living a rich, simple lives in the deep green mountains of Japan. And I just want to begin by reading a little bit from his blog. Largely, in our society of overwork, unfillable desires, and maddeningly rushed, we feel somehow that we have lost something important. For decades, Westerners have been looking to Buddhism and other Asian disciplines, as well as traditional peoples all over the world, to try to find a more satisfying way to live. Yet it's difficult for us to live in these people's ways, having grown up in an urbanized, industrialized culture. We are surrounded by excess, and we have so little time. In villages throughout the steep green mountains of Japan, arguably a more industrialized, overworked society than even our own, are some fascinating people who have chosen a slower, simpler way to live, I might add, very consciously. And their lives, they're rich in luxury of time. They have an abundance and richness of time, not wealth. They have time for contemplation, time to lose themselves in meandering conversations, and time to know the pleasures of the shimmering natural world. They have actualized the ideal of a simple and fulfilling life. And Andy is also the author of Writing Open the Mind. Is that correct? And he's going to be speaking about that book. And he leads workshops once a month here in Santa Cruz as well as Berkeley. Is that correct? And he'll talk a bit about that as well. And he's an essayist, a poet, and a professionally trained writing teacher. His writing has appeared in newspapers, magazines, and literary journals, including Adbusters, Creative Nonfiction, and the Japan Times. And Andy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Your book just amazed me. With each individual that I read about, I went deeper inside of myself and really had an opportunity, as we talked on the phone briefly, to explore what it is to be consumed in this consumer culture. And
yes,
how we don't I don't even know where my thoughts are originating, and the whole idea of groupism and how we're influenced subtly and not so subtly by others and forced to conform. And in Japan, it's a real conformist culture. So the pressures these individuals were under are just immense. Still, they carved out their own lives very methodically. They traveled oftentimes and they practiced amazing philosophies, but they're alive to them today. And I want to touch upon one individual, Ito's definition of emptiness, how he so succinctly put it, so that I had a deeper understanding, and their intimate connection with nature and plants and music and poetry. It's just immense.
Yes, he was really an inspiring person, and I put him right in the center of the book.
Oh.
He's kind of the elder of all the people in the book. I profiled 11 different individuals, and he's... He took up the way. He actually started off as a petroleum engineer, so he was born before the war. He was given a militarist education, and after the war, his family, he was a family of traditional craftspeople, but he was the second son, and traditional crafts were on the wane, and so his father sent him, like many young men of his generation, to learn technical skills. He was very skilled in math and science, and he's really integrated throughout his life. I'll continue to tell the story: the math, the science, and the philosophy as well as a deep spiritual connection. At 28 years old, he decided this job with a petroleum factory was not going to answer his deepest questions about life.
Which were they?
Well, I'll answer that the way he answered it to me, which is with a story from when he was about 10 years old, and that was 1945. It was the end of the war, and there was a firebombing of a city nearby him, and the whole city was blackened, and he escaped alive, but he became very concerned with the question of death. And as they say in Japanese, doko kara doko e, which literally translated is where from, where to. And and so this question is not where am I from, where are we going to, but just where from, where to. And so he looked for the answer first through travel and through study of art and poetry. And eventually he lived in India and Nepal, and he was very active as well with cultural preservation of indigenous cultures, particularly in Nepal, and trying to help sustain village life when all of India was industrializing. And he knew what is lost when there's a rapid industrialization.
And you quote his writing so beautifully. Would you want to just read something from, let's see where he wrote that. I was just so struck. And I guess he was in a village for quite a while. And then he came back 10 years later. And he wrote about the writings, the printing, the paintings in the homes were later written
yes.
on paper. And how individuals that had the talent to recreate the original paintings became wealthy. Then there was somewhat of a caste system.
Right.
And how again, right. and it was an economy, it wasn't an economy before, there was a cashless society,
right.
which is so rare. So that was just one example beautifully illustrated.
Yes, I love that passage, and I'll read
Me
that.
Too.
So this is something I
Thank
translated
you. You know
with
exactly
some
help. Where it is.
This is, I should give a little background. Mm-hmm. This is his writing about Mithila Village, Mithila. It's in the state of Bihar in northern India. It's a very poor region of India even today. These people in Mithila Village lived for centuries very simply, with very little cash. And he wrote this for... on the 20th anniversary of his first visit to Mithila. So this is much later when he was an older man. And, the main thing about Mithila for Ito-san is that, and I love this, he said, I finally understood the meaning of the Indian villages. What is the meaning of living this way? So I'll read an excerpt. This is his writing, and it's called The Folk Paintings of Mithila Village. Walking around the village, I saw much had changed. I was sad to notice that the arbor where I had strung my mosquito net to sleep 2 decades ago had been replaced by a brick building. In fact, everywhere, newly built brick houses and tile roofs had been replacing traditional thatch, and I could see the increasing disparity between the rich and the poor. I bought many of the paintings that the village is known for to give to people at our upcoming conference, and this was written for a conference of... folk art researchers in Japan, as well as to introduce other people in Japan to the beauty of their work. These are the same paintings I had come to see 20 years ago. In the more than 3,000 year history of these distinctive paintings, it is only recently that they have been painted on paper. Traditionally, they were painted on the walls of the house and were thought of as women's work, in the same way as cooking, cleaning, and doing the laundry was. And so girls would learn how to paint them as they grew up. These paintings were also always regarded as offerings to the gods, and it was not until recently that they were thought of as decorative or as, quote, art. About 35 years ago now, they started to paint on paper. This was also the time that the paintings started to be thought of as decorative, as a kind of adornment, as they became popularized and were turned into folk paintings for sale. The original spiritual nature of the art became more and more diluted. It seems to me that if the painting wasn't being made for a god, it could be drawn with a more carefree, easygoing feeling. That is to say, more lightly. And by the time of my visit, most villagers had completely given up painting on the walls in order to make commercialized versions on paper for sale. I also felt that the culture of the village had become more unmannerly and more rough and noisy, and the village itself seemed less well cared for. I wondered, had the influence exercised by cash income from the folk paintings begun? With the 3,000 years of history and tradition, the Mithila folk paintings were the communal property of all the people living in this region. And he's going to draw a metaphor here. I'm just going to interrupt for a second.
Sure.
With what's happening globally to all of us with our cultural property. So as I read this, you might want to think along those lines. Were the communal property of all the people living in this region. The villagers had a share in this fortune in their day-to-day life. When these paintings began to be painted on paper, this communal property became something that could be converted into cash. The paintings became material objects owned individually, and a big gap in income was born between people based on their talents as painters, or other things such as caste and class. Artists whose work was popular became rich, and they then became the target of jealousy from others. Long ago, the artistic vigor and talent was focused on the beautiful displays of artwork for festival days or at weddings, or as paintings for the gods themselves. But now this energy has all swung around toward the making of paintings as items for sale, and the quality of the original wall paintings has been neglected. I wonder if this is unavoidable in the ordinary course of things. And here's the key paragraph, and it's the end. Everywhere in the world, you can see this common property, our cultural heritage, being turned into money. And this is just one example of it. For the purposes of turning everything into economics, the nature and good culture of the whole earth, which are our common property, are being destroyed, and even the continuance of life itself is threatened. This is our era.
Yes, and I think about that so often myself, and it was so succinctly put. Everything seems to be privatized. It's happening now in the guise of debt.
And what's amazing is just, I even think here in Santa Cruz, how commodified everything becomes, even, you know, healing and, you know, sharing, all kinds of things. It's very discouraging sometimes.
And I feel like I am feeling like I'm being consumed. Where is the time to sit back and really listen to the crickets, as I used to when I was younger? I grew up on Cape Cod, to listen to the ocean waves. I have the ocean here, but I'm not thinking of it when I walk by. It was always very magical to me, the sound of the rushing waters, just enjoying the foam of the water. And there were all the little subtleties that I don't take the time to. And they seem also to be free in just about everyone that you interviewed, in not being a part of the cash economy, not working for someone else, where their time was not their own.
Yeah,
Each one had their own definition of satisfaction. They all use some cash,
I should say, but they've done as much as possible. Yeah, they've done as much as possible to provide for themselves, and I like that. The story of the ocean that you just spoke of, because why does that happen? We can buy books on, you know, seven ways to recycle better, or non-toxic cleansers, or, you know, studies of solar power versus, you know, wind or nuclear power. And that's important work. But that's why I thought that this book was something that really, well, let me start. When I met these people, I thought I really should write a book about them, because I felt like there was sort of an inner sustainability, an inner fiber that allowed them, and I didn't know what it was that allowed them to not chase after the next, you know, in my case, say the next email or the next blog post or the next appointment.
Whatever distraction.
Yeah, and maybe it's something important to us in some ways, but then we're not listening to the ocean. So
we're not listening to that little quiet voice within.
Well, I have a question, because obviously Japan is an interesting culture, because you have the modern culture that's become so technological, and obviously we see the ultimate of that is the nuclear power meltdown and all of this, but people so addicted to their gadgets, just like here, but and then this more grounded in the earth, deeper spiritual awareness. How did you experience that in Japan?
Their spiritual awareness?
Well, the contrast between those two things, the technological modernization. And
well, I mean, certainly everybody that I profiled in the book has left the city. They have many friends who are in the city and who are living very interesting lives as artists or activists in the city and making space inside of the city for themselves. You know, I think this might be a good time to introduce another person. She's the woman I interviewed in chapter 5. Her name is Asha Amemiya, and I started with a really provocative quote. And at the beginning of the chapter, she says, "If you don't have a lot of unsatisfied people, the system just stops dead." And I said, what do you mean by that? She said, "Well, you know, the new computer comes out and it's great and you buy it and you think, well, then you get it, right? But then the next one is even better. And it really is even better, you know, and it's the iPad or the, I mean, she didn't say that, but you know, it's got all these new functions. It's lighter, it's faster. The old one isn't working as well. And so you just keep chasing after it and you're only satisfied for a little bit. But as long as you stay unsatisfied and you keep chasing after that,
the rainbow.
There's no end to it. There's no end to it. She says, there's just, you know, you just keep going after it. So the way she looked at me and she said, you know, just enough. It's like when my stomach is full, it's enough. I'm through. And so that's one of the ways she has dealt with it. I think
she has certain questions that she lived by. Will it harm someone? What I do, what I say? Is it close to me? Is it real? Is it authentic? And there was a third.
Does it involve using money?
Yes.
Does it involve using money?
And so she had certain guidelines or...
Yeah. I mean, you know, Japan really is, I mean, when I first...
But she said they're unusual, the individuals. They aren't, I don't think they're representative of most Japanese today or modern Japanese.
They are very, very unusual in a lot of ways, but I also think there's something that is very Japanese about them that you would find in everyday mainstream Japan. I think there's a certain self-discipline, a lot of self-discipline, a lot of real concern for other people that you'll find, you know, in everyday delivery people and bus drivers and salespeople, that really the concern is directed outwards. And I think that really helps. And I think in mainstream, you'll find even in some of the denser areas of Tokyo, people growing their own rice, a lot of people grow their own food. It's not so far away. And I think this is something that I wanted to bring back to the United States because, well, in my case, my grandfather and grandmother used cash to get everything they needed. Mm-hmm. My great-grandparents used cash to get everything they needed. But up until after the war, at least in the mountains, you know, up until maybe even the mid-50s, the great majority of people in the mountains of Japan used very little cash. They did what they needed. So this is a book, strangely to say, about economics. Economics of how do you provide for what you need and how do you decide what it is you need.
So and timely now, too.
So they used barter? Or
There's a fair amount of barter. There's a lot of making your own baskets, for example, gathering your own wood, and just using an awful lot less.
And they lasted.
Yeah. And
what they created.
You know, so some of them are potters, and you know, that's their pottery.
But yeah, even the pottery and what they created had a story behind it.
Yeah.
Everything had so much more meaning.
And, you know, I mean, they're not perfect people.
No.
And they've got, you know, they're all... different. It's not a hard-hitting book of journalism. I'm really celebrating these people, but I do, you know, want people to know that there's, you know, they're struggling in different ways. Yeah, so they're really a great group of people, and they've known each other in different ways. They don't live in a commune. They live in all kinds of different areas of Japan for 30 or 40 years, and they met each other, interestingly, in Nepal and India.
Yeah, so. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Temples and teachers that they followed and how they kind of came together. And
Well, a lot of the people in Japan who are interested in things outside of their own country, and it's like the United States, you know, a lot of people in the United States are not interested in anything outside of their own world. But those who are tend to be interested in the West, in sort of Beethoven and Vivaldi and, you know, the Empire State Building and the Grand Canyon or whatever, you know, Hollywood movies. But these people were not so interested, and they were turning east. And
turning inward.
And turning inward, too. But in their travels, they met a Buddhist priest, a Zen Buddhist priest, who, it's hereditary in Japan, so his father, his grandfather were Buddhist priests, and he had decided that he didn't like the formal nature and the almost despiritualized nature of Zen Buddhism in Japan, and the commercialism, and he thought he was not going to go into his father's profession, so he left, and he found in Nepal much more living Buddhism, Nepali Buddhism, which is a very small area just in the Kathmandu Valley. It exists, and he started doing some research on it, and along the way, he just opened up the house he was renting for Japanese travelers, any travelers to come in and stay. And that was in the late 70s and early 80s, and they did a number of cultural preservation projects trying to help keep the craft work of the Nepali villagers alive. And they learned a lot from the Nepalis, and that was another thing I really wanted to emphasize, is that the Nepalis were living with so much less, but they seemed, to many of the people in the book, to be a lot more satisfied than the people that they saw at home in Japan. And it wasn't just sort of a, you know, I'm a tourist and I'm going through and I'm catching one smiling face and saying, oh, that's, they're more satisfied. It was more a, you know, they lived there for many years and they found that without so many material things, but with a deeper spiritual connection, they were finding more of what we're here for, you know, why are we alive? So that's, many of them were influenced. And one guy in chapter two, Mr.
Deeply
Nakamura,
and in different ways too.
He lived in the mountains in a Sherpa village for almost 10 years, and they really had almost nothing. And this is the thing I want to emphasize: is he readjusted, he recalibrated his heart, his desires by living there for a long time, by living with so much less. And when he came back to Japan, he realized he could live in the same way. And he works for money about 5 weeks a year, 6 weeks a year. That's it. He goes to do some manual labor job, part-time, makes as much as he needs, grows a lot of his own food, and doesn't use so much. And that's and it's an interesting idea. I'd like to live, I'm starting to live a little more that way myself, but I think that actually being with people who are living that way and have lived that way for centuries is more of a
has more of an impact.
Yeah, it really changes the value system you have inside.
And you have an, I would imagine, not having done it myself, that it would give you a deeper understanding of, well, I want to get into it, impermanence. And again, Ito wrote about that as well. So beautifully, and how the Eastern way of being is much more, talking about cliche, but in harmony with the natural way of being. And it's not contrary, because everything is transient.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great word in Japanese, mujōkan, which is the feeling of impermanence. And it's stressed throughout all parts of Japanese culture. So it's really a, that's an important teaching.
And in Indian, too,
yeah,
I discovered India. And Native Americans here as well, in different ways. Those are, I think you know it. I want you to read next then Ito's writing about impermanence. I don't remember exactly where it was. Oh, and about emptiness and how we return from where we came from. It's the same place, and that we're energy.
Yeah.
And it's constantly changing, and it expands and it contracts. And that's just the way it is. It's beautiful. And that's a truth that you can't change that. He has such a grasp, not just an intellectual grasp. He knows it from his practices daily and looking for the depth. Where do we go when we cease to exist? It's just real. I was in tears when I read that because it was so beautifully.
I'm very moved by him. Thank you very much. So this is again.
I buy them all, but that was just the last chapter I read just before you came in. So it's still, they're still very much with me, these individuals. And he passed away, I guess.
Yeah, he did. So let me just say that this is from a different kind of luxury, Japanese Lessons in Simple Living and Inner Abundance, and it is available actually in Santa Cruz at Chai Khana, if you know where Chai Khana is, across from the Bagelry.
A tea house.
Oh, tea house, okay.
And also at Rivendell, and it's on order at Bookshop Santa Cruz and, of course, online as well.
We want to support our independent bookstores.
We do. So the lead up to this here, Ito-san really, later in his life, looked into how to bring together both theoretical astrophysics, quantum mechanics, Chinese philosophy, and Hindu philosophy into one unified understanding. And what I found great was that, I mean, these terms of, you know, impermanence and emptiness, before I met these people, I mean, I read a lot of books about it, but I hadn't really understood it. I thought it was very sort of abstract, and
I'm still struggling.
Yeah, and for some, in some ways, each of them were able to make these abstract concepts more real to me in my real life. So, this is a quote again from Akira Ito, and I will read it just a couple paragraphs. Born of nothingness and returning to emptiness, the universe is ceaseless change. In the process of this change, from time to time, and by sheer coincidence, existence or being makes its apparition. But it is not permitted to exist permanently. Although life is but a phenomenon in the midst of this change, it hungers for permanence and seeks the maintenance of pattern. Even though ultimately the universe is headed in the direction of absolute nothingness, life attempts to move in the exact opposite direction. Thus, it is an irrational and absurd kind of existence. In the East, it has been recommended that we should live in such a way as to attempt to overcome this irrationality by trying to actually experience the state of becoming one body with the universe. By obeying this basic law of ceaseless change, heading inexorably toward nothingness. This is often spoken of as the transitory outlook on the world, or natural idleness. To speak in general terms, the West has placed great importance on respect for life, as well as on those things that are immutable and things that last forever. In the East, as a way to stay in touch with our own spirit, predominance has been put on obeying the basic law of ceaseless change headed in the direction of absolute nothingness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Well, on that note, shall we call your friend?
Janaea, the host here, has asked. Go ahead.
Yes, one of the individuals that were interviewed, was she an anti-nuclear activist?
Yes, yeah.
So, of course, it's very timely, given they've had their second earthquake today and the major tsunami and the predominance of nuclear reactors that are now melting. And I'll be calling her in a few minutes, and we're going to play some music that you brought in. Is this the flute?
So let me give you a little introduction to Atsuko, and then kind of tell you a little bit about the music, and then while the listeners are listening to the music, then we can try to reach her. Atsuko is in chapter 3. She's the first person I met, and she introduced me to pretty much everybody else in the book, and really in some ways this is her book too. She has studied quite a bit of English, so she's one of the few people in the book, all of us was otherwise translated from Japanese, who speaks English, and she started a group after the Chernobyl incident when her daughters were small, and there was so much radiation escaping from the meltdown there. And she thought that, and she said interestingly, she said, mothers shouldn't have to do this. Mothers should be able to focus on raising their children. But because nobody else was doing it, we felt that we had to. So she formed a group of mothers to try to inform other people about the dangers of nuclear power, and I've been speaking to her a fair amount. She's not in northern Japan. She's in southwestern Japan, but you know, everyone in Japan, in fact, us here as well, we are affected by the nuclear disaster. And perhaps after we speak to her, there's some both ways to help out organizations that are fighting nuclear power over there, as well as there's going to be a protest on Sunday in San Francisco against nuclear power at Dolores Park at 1 p.m. And I'll put that on my blog, the information about that.
Yeah, that's an excellent thing to bring up. That protest actually covers many bases: nuclear power, stop the interventions in wars, stand up for labor rights. So there should be, it's 11 o'clock at Dolores Park in San Francisco, and the march will be at 1, I believe.
You can cover it for the show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're going to try to reach Atsuko, but I'm going to, I brought in some music. Janaea suggested that I bring in some. This is by a man named Bob Uchida and his band Barnagita. It's from an album called Water Island. It's folk music, modern folk music from rural Japan. I find it very beautiful. It's hammer dulcimer as well. And let's see if we can reach Atsuko.
Yes. There we go. Welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from Japan. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Oh, great. Hi. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, and the show is Tickling the Belly of the Beast. And just want to welcome you on the program, and thank you for taking the time to come and share with us what's going on over there and a little bit about yourself.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So what? There was another earthquake today, I understand. My name is Janaea, and with me is Bear, my co-host. And I understand there was another earthquake today.
Yes.
Oh, boy. And how is everyone dealing with the fallout from, I guess it is a nuclear meltdown.
So how are they dealing with it? Janaea is asking Atsuko, how are people handling the fallout from the nuclear power station?
Oh, you mean professionals or us as common citizens?
The common citizens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You see, we live very remote area, so actually there aren't many things we can do. So we are just collecting money and send them to those disastrous areas.
Mm-hmm.
And as the community, we are preparing to accept the people who have lost homes.
So does that mean that people are going to move from that area down to where you're living?
Mm. Yes.
So are they being forced to relocate, or is this a choice?
It's not forced, and actually those people want to live near where they used to live, so maybe there won't be many people who will move to the remote area.
So there may not be that many moving?
The nearest place is where it's not contaminated.
So yes. Where Atsuko lives is quite far away, so even though her village is inviting people, it's really a long way away, so they probably wouldn't want to move that far away, I think is what she's saying.
Mm-hmm. But most people are in refugee camps or a situation without people haven't been resettled yet. There are a lot of people in need at this point. True?
Yes, it's true. And it's very... it depends on the place. You know, in some place there are many things already reached. But in people, especially I heard whose house has remained... people who returned to their home are in shortage of food or electricity.
Mm-hmm.
In the refugee camps, people know there are many people staying there, so they send things.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who've returned home don't have food or water.
Mm.
And it depends upon the place how much they got. Now, Atsuko, you had a statement that you wanted to tell Americans who might be listening about nuclear power.
I want to see what's happening now in Japan. You know, Japan is thought to be a very technologically developed country,
mm-hmm.
but still we have made such a disastrous accident, and I want you to see what's happening in Japan and stop building any more nuclear power stations,
mm-hmm.
and eventually close down the existing ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we appreciate that. Last week, we have nuclear power plants here that are very unsafe, and there's a lot of corruption as well with the safety and such things. And last week, we interviewed some people here about trying to get the safety better where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in solidarity with you.
Very much so.
Yeah, you know, every day in Japan, the new power industry says mm-hmm. after the accident that it was not expected, you know. But I think if you cannot expect the unexpected, you shouldn't do that. The disaster of nuclear power is too huge to let it happen.
We agree, totally.
Well, we saw in the news also that they were informed, that the utility company was informed that there had been a tsunami of that size over 1,000 years ago, but they said, oh, that was so long ago, you know, they didn't pay attention.
It was underestimated because, you know, the profit from the nuclear is too huge to turn down. So they turned down the dangerousness of it.
And they cut corners.
They make too much money, is what you're saying, the profits they make.
Yeah.
You were saying to me, Atsuko, when we were speaking yesterday about comparing a nuclear bomb and a nuclear power plant. Would you tell that to people?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll tell it. The nuclear power is more dangerous than the atomic bomb, according to my idea. Because atomic bomb is just atomic bomb target a small area, and it's just a kind of acute, you know.
Acute.
But the nuclear power station is chronic.
It goes on and on.
Yes, it continues releasing radioactive substances. Even when it's under control, you know. And it piles up a huge amount of used fuel. And we have to cool it down as long as we live, you know. And we spend a lot of energy for that.
Cooling down the used fuel. So we use energy in order to cool down the used fuel.
It's such a waste.
Yeah,
we have here a lot of the people promoting nuclear power now are justifying it because they say we need it because of global warming and instead of coal. So they're using that argument now. But we see that the nuclear power uses a lot of those energies as well.
Yeah. It's very clear. And if you really want to know it, you will know it. That the big medium is not telling about that, but if you really want to know, you can find the different news resource. And you will know the truth.
Can you recommend any? Here in the States or in Japan?
In Japan, there are many small groups, but I don't know how to call it in English.
Yes, well, actually, Cynthia, when I was speaking with Atsuko, go ahead.
You already have a great group like Greenpeace.
Greenpeace.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We do.
And Greenpeace is tracking in Japan what's going on, and they're fighting nuclear power here. So, but also Atsuko told me some Japanese anti-nuclear groups and information centers that people can donate to, and I've actually just put that on my blog so people can go to that and find out ways to actually send some money to the anti-nuclear groups, and that's... DifferentKindOfLuxury.com is my blog. No A. DifferentKindOfLuxury.com.
Well, I was curious because I know in Japan, I think a lot of us who have been anti-nuclear activists for many years were surprised that people after Hiroshima and Nagasaki and that whole history were so accepting of nuclear power. And of course, we have been here and all over the world, unfortunately. But I wondered now, with what's happened, if there's going to be a very strong movement, if you see anything happening yet in terms of people coming together to at this point, or if it's still people are just still recovering from the disaster and nothing has happened much yet.
You understand his question? Do you think there's a new movement in Japan against nuclear power, Atsuko?
Yeah. Old groups started activities again vigorously, but the remaining others about those people, I am not expecting much. You know, we have to change them. It's very difficult to change their way of thinking. Mm-hmm. They're already fixed. So maybe the electric industry would commercialize again more and more and say other nuclear power plants are safe and mm-hmm. they would do more carefully. So people might believe it again.
Until they start seeing the real dangers, which unfortunately...
Yeah. Can you tell a little bit more about the fix? I mean, I've lived in Japan, but many of the listeners have never lived there. You said their ideas are fixed. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, we know. Yeah, we are trained to not to doubt the authority or to think deeply, and we are trained just to copy or.
Can you speak a little louder, Atsuko? Can you speak a little louder? Yes. Yes, we can't hear you.
And think very surface things. We are not trained to, create my own ideas. So it's very difficult. We are accustomed to follow others' ideas.
Mm-hmm. There's more conformity of thought.
Thank you very much, Atsuko. You're speaking a lot longer than you.
I'm very sorry. I cannot express well.
Oh, actually, you're expressing very clearly.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on and taking your time and. We'll hopefully be able to send over some assistance.
Well, we wish you the best with recovering and the healing of the nation and all the people there. So there are many people's prayers here, and hopefully there'll be a lot of material help as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Bye-bye, Atsuko.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here we go. Well, that was Ashiko.
Atsuko Watanabe.
Atsuko Watanabe.
And she's the person I profiled in Chapter 3 of A Different Kind of Luxury.
One of 11. And we're speaking with Andy...
Couturier.
Who also is the author of Writing Open the Mind. And he teaches classes on Thursday evenings from 7 to 10, beginning April 28th. That'll be an 8-week course. And is that in Santa Cruz at UCSC?
It's not at UCSC.
No.
No, that's I'll be lecturing at UCSC, but my classes are are separate from UCSC.
Oh.
My lecture at UCSC is in May, May 23rd, Monday night, part of the ESLP series.
Great. But on April 28th, right around the corner, actually, it will be taught.
It's going to be downtown Santa Cruz. If you are interested in finding out more, you can contact me either by phone or by email or looking at the website for my writing classes. So I've got a Thursday evening class and a Thursday morning class coming up. Should I give that information?
Yes, theopening.org and then your phone number.
Yeah, theopening.org or you can call me at 831-728-9983 or andy@theopening.org is my email, and I can put you on the email list about the classes.
Great. And I understand this book, Writing Open the Mind, is quite different from the one where you interviewed.
My partner says people won't believe it's written by the same person.
Can you say a little? I haven't had an opportunity to read it. I was so involved with the other one, enthralled.
Okay, thank you. It's called Writing Open the Mind, and the subtitle is Tapping the Subconscious to Free the Writing and the Writer, and it came out in 2005. And basically, it's And I was talking to a Japanese friend. I said, I don't even know what's in common between these two books. And he said, well, maybe it's that word inner abundance. He said, how to find something really rich inside your own self. So a lot of writing books are filled with rules and maybe suggestions of topics to write about. And I think that people have things they really want to write about. They don't need a whole lot of, say, topics necessarily. But they need some way to access different parts of their own mind, because just through everyday life, we get into ruts, we get into these, even in our brains, the neurochemistry, it's kind of like
the patterns.
Yeah, the patterns that we get into. And I don't think we can even stop that just in the everyday nature of, you know, whatever we do for work or going back and forth between place A and place B and using language in the same way. And the idea of the exercises, or I call them experiments in the book, is to try to help people free themselves as opposed to just exhorting them to be free, to actually take a very playful approach to writing and see if you can stumble upon your own genius, the same genius that you might find in dreams at night or those moments of heightened creativity. How can you access that just in your everyday life? So I like to think about it as accessing different parts of your brain. So we might do scrambling up word sequences. We might play with the sounds of words themselves. We might, one of my favorite exercises is called a smorgasbord of genres. So you take a topic and you write it first as a to-do list, and then the same topic as a letter of complaint, and then you write it as a advice column, and then you might write it as a piece of advertising, and then you might write it as a prayer. It's all on the same topic, but what happens is you find different parts of your own self that are conjured up by using these different genres to write from. It's very based in free
writing. For the imagination.
Yeah, and it's you can actually write things that you didn't even know you knew. I mean, you finish writing and you look back and there it is in your handwriting, and you've learned something that you didn't even think first. So the way we're traditionally told to write is write about what you know, think it first, choose the right words. And
it's tedious and judgmental. You're circumventing both in this process.
And this is about trying to get yourself to a place where things are coming out of you through free writing. It's really a free writing course, but to see how free we can get in our free writing to just really unleash the surprising parts of our brain. I mean, you know, when you have a dream and something totally unexpected happens and it's very rich in symbolism, that part of your brain is with you in your waking hours. It's just that the left brain, the one that gets you from point A to point B, or makes your, you know, how many things do I have to do today, or just drives your car, that part of the brain often disallows that that dreaming mind. But it is possible to access it in your writing, and that's what writing open the mind is more about, and that's what I do in my writing classes.
It sounds like fun, and the fear so many of us have. I enjoy writing, but I also got locked into, am I doing this correctly after so many years of red marks and my papers? Well, I will have to check it out myself, and that is beginning April 28th on Thursdays.
Right, and then May 12th is the morning class.
And May 12th is the morning class, and that's at UCSC.
I'm sorry, it's not at UCSC. It's downtown Santa Cruz.
Oh, downtown Santa Cruz.
Right, but I am speaking up at UCSC. I've been invited as a lecturer to speak about the first book as part of the ESLP program.
Okay, I keep wanting to go up.
Yeah.
And that's what Classroom Unit 2, what's the date on that? May 23rd?
May 23rd at 7
p.m. May 23rd at 7 p.m. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'd like to go back to a different kind of luxury for
sure,
a moment.
Sure, absolutely.
What kept going through my mind as I was reading it was evolvement.
Evolvement?
Evolvement. The evolvement of each individual and how they came to live so consciously in the mountains, and how succinctly they thought about what they were speaking and consciously lived everything they did. Not everything, I'm imagining, but a lot of what they did had so much thought behind it. And they were just so naturally living. And I imagine that this book evolved in a similar manner. So a roundabout way of asking, how did you come to write it? How did it evolve for you? And how did it impact you?
Well, it is actually connected with the first book. Really, I actually studied at UCSC in the 80s, and I thought I was going to go into African development and population work, environmental work. We ended up in Japan, my partner and I, in the late 80s. We were there primarily to teach English so that we could earn some money, save some money, just doing something that we didn't feel was a bad thing, use that money to buy some land in the country. Not knowing that there were Japanese people living in the country, not knowing that there was this rich culture of people connected in with that ancient Buddhist and Hindu cultures, and that they were living in these old farmhouses.
Can you say a little bit about the farmhouses? That's a distracting a bit, but it allows people to live more simply.
Sure.
So they're affordable.
I can actually tie them in together. So in 1990, around Earth Day, I actually first met Atsuko, who we just spoke to. I will tell the story of meeting her. She, the first thing she said to me was very challenging. She said, and this is not in the book, she said, how can you be working for that company where I was teaching English? What kind of environmentalist are you really? Before even saying hello. And so I immediately liked her because she wasn't being all deferential and polite. And I explained, how I got into teaching English at a pharmaceutical company. But one of the things that happened to me is I did feel bad about doing that. And so I offered a free writing class for environmentalists so that people could speak about these large-scale dam projects or about electricity or about nuclear power. And Atsuko was part of that group. And after a few weeks, she said, why don't you come visit us in the mountains at our house where we live in an old farmhouse for very little rent, and we grow our own food. And I thought, wait a minute, that's why I'm in Japan, to come back to California to do that myself. And here are some Japanese people doing it. So we said yes, and that day just changed my life. It was more than 20 years ago now, and it's incredibly. I mean, these old farmhouses got abandoned, and when everyone moved to the cities, it's you can't make a ton of money living in the mountains, and so a lot of people rushed to Tokyo and Osaka, and big cities there to work in the large companies that we're all familiar with, Toyota and Hitachi and Canon and Nikon and all of these companies, and they were able to live a more comfortable life by using money. So these houses were empty and often falling into disrepair. So the house that Atsuko was calling us from just now was she rents it for $50 a year.
Photographs. There are beautiful photographs in the book also of these old farmhouses and the terraced gardens. And
how is that possible, though? $50 a year? I know that things are not cheap in Japan.
Well, that's a good question. Basically, there's a very strong feeling among mainstream society that you want to be as close as possible to the train station. You want to be, if you're going to have a job, you often are working 60, 70, 80, sometimes 90 hours of work. There's a week to work. There's actually a term in Japanese, karoshi, which is death from overwork. And this does happen with some frequency. And people don't want to be 2 hours out into the mountains. So a lot of these houses are completely abandoned. The village where Atsuko was calling us from in Kamikatsu is had 50 years ago had 9,000 people. It now has 3,000 people. So a lot of these houses fell into disrepair. So if someone was willing to come there and clean it up, maintain it, cut the weeds back from the garden, and do something, the owner would be more than happy to have them do that. So and to answer your first question, how did this book evolve?
Yes,
I met them, and her husband as well, who's profiled in chapter 8, really an extraordinary person, and some of the people who lived nearby them. And they have a festival every year in April. It's actually going on right now in Nagoya, and I went to that my second time in Japan, and I met a lot of the other people who came there, and realized that in other parts of Japan, they were also living a different kind of life from each other, where they were all, to some extent or another, growing their own food, making art, and had lots of time for deep conversation. And their conversations are so amazing, so different from what I had with my English students who mm-hmm. were so busy working, they were not able to have a richer life. And, you know, for example, Atsuko's husband, he's, you know, whether you're talking about the arts of Afghanistan in the 3rd century or whether you're talking about the Latin or Hindi name for a particular botanical plant or mm-hmm. whether you're talking about Heidegger, he's got lots of time because he's not chasing after money. And he doesn't have a lot of money, but he grows his own food. He has this house and he's satisfied with less. So he's able to pursue his own creativity, his art. And as I got to know more and more of these people, I thought, you know, they really have some wisdom for us, even so-called yes. progressives or environmentalists in the United States, how we can actually not be contributing to the destruction of the earth and destruction of our own time on, mm-hmm. on earth mm-hmm. And really valuing our lives by not falling for the many enticements of the next new cell phone or iPad or a faster car or better this or nicer, you know, apartment or whatever it is that we yearn for.
And they saw that evolution within their own country, too. It wasn't always that way until after World War II when they were probably just born.
Well, I was going to ask... How do people live? They live collectively?
These people don't. There are Japanese collectives. And in fact, the music we were playing some time ago is a great little commune up in the mountains. But it's not generally communes. People, they live in villages with a lot of Japanese villages are mostly elderly people. Not so many young people want to stay there anymore. They find it boring. And they want to move to the city where there's more entertainment. They get along well with their neighbors. Some of them interact a lot with their neighbors. Some of them don't. The folks in chapter 7 and 10 and 11 are in about 4 hours outside of Tokyo, kind of closer in, and they have a community around them where there's a lot of organic farmers and artists and craftspeople. There, but some others live very, very far out, and there's not so many people of like mind there, but they're satisfied with that.
Hmm. And two, each one seemed to have mentors, some alive, some not, that really impacts how they live. One was Tagore.
Yes. So,
and then Rudolf Steiner and...
That's a great thing to pick up. I mean, I think this is something that...
They live their lives almost.
That we don't do as much. We're not culturally as focused on or just brought up to think, you know, in our individualism, like, well, I know better than anybody else and certainly an old person and I don't really need to learn anything from my elders is, I bet that's a bit of a simplification of the way we think about it in the West, but in Japan, mm-hmm. you really do look up to your elders or, you know, try to walk in their footsteps. So a number of them, you know, some of them, Rudolf Steiner, Atsuko is very influenced by Rudolf Steiner. Amimiya, the one I spoke about earlier, who said, I've had enough. She's very influenced by Tagore. She lived in Tagore's village in India. And that story is also told in the book.
And about the education of sensitivity, they cultivated, they tried to encourage raising their children with a heightened sensitivity as opposed to stifling the senses and rote learning. It was opening up the natural world. Do you want to share any passages from...
Sure.
I don't remember exactly where they were, but you wrote about it so beautifully.
Well, this is again in chapter 5.
She was the spirited
woman. She was
very outspoken.
Giving me a hard time.
Japanese. I can see why.
Yeah.
Well, no, not because you were deserving, but that's her nature. And the way she would scold her children at different times, and her daughters, uh-huh. how independent and spirited they were. And free thinking. You interviewed one of her daughters, too,
yes,
at the
I did.
University.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
So did you want me to read a passage from Tagore first? Is that
our experience of his school, the Tagore?
Okay, so let me just introduce people to Rabindranath Tagore. He was the first Asian to win the Nobel Prize in Literature, or any Nobel Prize, I believe, in 1916. He was both a poet and a dramatist, a musician, a philosopher. He knew and worked alongside Gandhi, although with quite a different emphasis. And he started a school that was everything from elementary school all the way up through a university, which is north of Calcutta in the state of West Bengal at Shantiniketan. And Amemiya and her partner Yamashita, who I profile in chapter 9, lived there for 10 years. And he taught Japanese literature there. And she was very moved by Tagore in, as you said, the cultivation of sentiments, the cultivation of sentiments, cultivation of sensitivity. And so Tagore, I'll give just a short introduction to Tagore's ideas here. This is Tagore. We may become powerful by knowledge, but we attain fullness by sympathy. But we find that this education of sympathy is not only systematically ignored in schools, but is severely repressed. From our very childhood, our life is weaned away from nature, and our mind and the world are set in opposition. We are made to lose our world to find a bag full of information instead. We rob the child of his earth to teach him geography, of language to teach him grammar. His hunger is for the epic, but he is supplied with chronicles of facts and dates. Child nature protests against such calamity with all its power of suffering, subdued at last into silence by punishment. I just found that very powerful.
Me too.
And then it was 1917 that he wrote that. Then I say about how she raised her daughters and how vibrant and alive they were.
Such examples of that education.
And they
system.
Really didn't, you know, gave the children a chance to really experience their creativity, and the children speak Bengali, which is very funny to go deep into the mountains.
And they know the old dances.
Yeah, one of them gave a performance of Tagore's choreography. And later on I do talk to her, and she also gives some of her reservations about growing up the way she did and that generation's view on it, but also how she became much stronger than a lot of the people that she's going to school with in Osaka.
I just was really touched by that. And also, this is going to another direction here, but again, Ito's deep connection to the land and his awareness of the cycles of life and the importance of the sun and plants, photosynthesis. There was another quote. Did he write that, or did you both? And then you commented, but the going back and forth, a discussion was beautiful. I'd love to have our listeners have a flavor of that intimacy. And it's not just something that he lives, that he sees it.
So this again is Akira Ito in chapter 6 of
he
a different kind.
He doesn't have to seek it out. It's all around him. It's in him.
From a different kind of luxury. Let's see.
This is just a taste of what the book is all about. It took me deep, deep within.
So this is some of his writing on living. He lives in the forest. Many of the people in the book live in the rice paddies. But he lives deep in the forest near Mount Fuji. And this is some of his writing. Growing like thunderheads all summer long, the trees and plants of the woodlands thrive and cover every bit of the mountain until they finally begin to lose their momentum. And in the dark shadows of a forest that has gone through its adolescence and prime, one feels a touch of sadness. The forest in September is so abundant in foliage that underneath everything is darkened. However, in winter the trees lose their leaves and you can see through the woods very well. Then the dramatic transformation that a mixed species forest goes through every year in early spring is truly extraordinary. Young shoots growing from the branches of trees burn like light green flames, and before long the forest, which had been empty, is filled with green leaves. Walking over the path that leads to my house and observing the changes, I understand the Buddhist phenomenon of quote, existence emerging from nothingness, and the phenomenon from modern physics of energy transforming into matter. I understand that these abstract philosophical ideas represent exactly what is happening here. Energy transforming into matter is the process of photosynthesis. Sunshine energy with carbon dioxide creating organic compounds, that is to say plants creating leaves with the energy they have taken in. Existence emerging from nothingness can be seen when the shoots and then leaves appear from the bare branches of the trees using that potent energy nourishment. And then in the autumn they fall off of the trees and return into the forest or into their original state of, quote, emptiness or, quote, nothingness. Thus, in the forest, I'm able to learn that these phases of the circulation of energy, the formation and disappearance, are common to all phenomena of energy, and this understanding can advance my work in the contemplation of the universe as a phenomenon of energy.
Mm-hmm. Well written.
Wow, beautiful.
Isn't it? The whole book is like this. The conversations you share, you feel like you're right there. Mm. It's the intimacy together, the intimacy with the land, the truth of their philosophies. They're not philosophy, it's not a lifestyle, and you write about that. It's a way of being that is a bit foreign in this
Well, I don't think it's foreign
materialism.
To any indigenous culture. I think that as part of United
changing.
States, many of us have come from other places originally. Our ancestors, so we don't have quite the rootedness that some of these other cultures have.
Well, I'd like to make a Santa Cruz comment on this. I mean, I do know that, just to mention this book's available at the Tea House Chicana and at Rivendell and places like that, I think.
And mine is personally autographed.
Yeah, I think places like Chicana and Rivendell and other places in the Santa Cruz community, people are really reaching back into Chinese philosophy and to...
Oh, we're unusual, though.
A lot of things started in Santa Cruz. I believe the mountain bike started in Santa Cruz.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. So I think there's some hope.
There's hope.
And I think that I have some good friends who are living incredibly simply here in the United States who are living with very little money and with a lot of time and making their art, and so it's
we
there.
We have to go to Japan to find
it. Well, and it's also, this book wouldn't exist if I hadn't sort of gone there, interviewed them, and publicized it, and did readings and
it's
talks.
So,
people don't necessarily who are living that way. They're not there to advertise their lives. They're not there to promote it.
No.
So we don't necessarily know about it. Doesn't mean that it isn't happening. That all over,
mm-hmm.
I've met people all over the United States who are living very simply. I met a woman in the mountains up here in Happy Valley, who's in her 80s, and she read the book and she said, "These people are me," and she has been living that way for eight decades. So it's she's fantastic. So I think it's not absent here. It's just you don't necessarily, nobody's putting it on a billboard. No one's jumping up and down and saying it's happening. And if you're listening to this, you can also live a slower life yourself and have a richer life. And that's why I put all the time and energy into writing this to inspire people to actually use less resources.
Yeah.
So I know we're going to be running out of time very soon. I wanted to actually mention something that's coming up. A number of us have been aware on, an intuitive level of these earthquakes and earth changes coming up. And there's been different spiritual communities mentioning the Indian tradition, been involved with Swami Kaleshwar. And I had kind of had visions of the earthquake in Japan, California, and another one in India coming up. And Swami Kaleshwar had also mentioned this too, and a lot of us feel like there's a potential for a big earthquake coming in California very soon, as well as Japan. And so we're putting out prayers at this time to alleviate that, prayers for Japan, prayers to alleviate and
calm
the Mother Earth here. And so I would say that whoever has their own prayers, just put those prayers out. But there's also, if you would like, there's a mantra that we're sharing generally that could be used also, and that's Guru Guru Paramaguru Rakshamam Rakshamam Rakshamam. And what that means is to all the gurus, to all the masters and saints and holy people, high energies, protection. We ask protection. So, again, that's Guru Guru Paramaguru Rakshamam Rakshamam Rakshamam, or whatever prayers you have in whatever tradition you have. To all put our hearts together, our focus to calming the earth, to bringing alleviation, to make it through these changes in a good way.
And that mantra is very powerful and very ancient. Again, it's simple, and the words have a lot of power, even if you don't know the meanings, and it's simple. Om Guru Guru Paramaguru Rakshamam Rakshamam Rakshamam. I want to thank you for listening. Next week, I believe Alan will be on. I may be on as well. And I want to thank Andy
Couturier.
I am so sorry. I'm having trouble pronouncing your name, Andy Couturier, for coming on and sharing that rich book that is filling any hole in my heart just in the process of reading it.
Well, I thank you for
such
letting me
delight on.
And if you want to find out more about the people in Japan and ways to help them, I've put some organizations that are fighting nuclear power over there on the blog, and there's excerpts from the book there, although of course we hope that you actually support
the author
and the bookstores by getting it, but you can find out a little bit more at differentkindofluxury.com, and you can also find about my writing classes at theopening.org.
And Andy, if there are any other classes that you're going to be leading in the future or anything else that you know the people need, feel free to call in here. You can come in and speak anytime, or you can just
give us the information
and I'll pass it on to the other programmers as well. I love what you're doing. And thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And coming in and doing all of this and bringing it forward.
And we'll mention, again, two things that are coming up. The demonstration in San Francisco on Sunday, which will be starting at 11 a.m. at Dolores Park, which is in the Mission. That's, I think, around 18th and Valencia, I believe. But anyway, it will be many different issues all coming together, unifying around ending the wars, not cutting social services, supporting labor, stopping, you know, nuclear power. So that's going to be happening. There's also, for people who are up for going to Diablo Canyon, there's going to be that demonstration on the 16th at Avila Beach near San Luis Obispo. Mothers for Peace is putting that on. So that's on April 16th, and hopefully there'll be some carpooling from this area and other areas going down to San Luis Obispo.
Well, thank you, Bear. Next. And now we have Palestinian news, and following that, free speech news, and then Informativo. Informativo, sorry. And we'll be back next week at 3 p.m. And here is Palestinian news.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, April 7th, 2011. One Palestinian killed in Gaza and two injured in Israel, and the Israeli military kidnaps a number of Palestinian civilians in the West Bank. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli shelling has killed one in Gaza and injured